This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. This is Eben Fowler, Director of Operations for Bot Radio Network. I'm sitting in again for Tony today. Glad to have you along. We've got a bunch of stuff to talk about in today's broadcast. First of all, breaking news as of this afternoon. Senator John McCain said he won't support the Graham-Cassidy health care proposal the Senate will consider next week. We'll be talking with Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment, to sort out what that all means. Last night in D.C., some of the most liberal journalists in the media industry were dishonored at the Media Research Center's gala. MRC's Tim Graham will tell us about those honors. And you can imagine a fifth grader being told to use the wrong pronoun when addressing the teacher. Well, that's what's happening in one classroom in a Tallahassee, Florida school. Kathy Roos, FRC's, and that's Family Research Council's, Senior Fellow of Legal Studies, will join us with her insights about that. Of course, Tallahassee's not the only place that's going on. That crazy stuff is going on. But this is a good example of it, or a bad example, depending on how you look at it. Brace yourself. Have you heard that according to one so-called Christian numerologist, a planet is supposed to crash into Earth, causing the end of the world? Well, apparently he's backtracking today, but Dr. Michael Brown of FIRE School of Ministry and noted author will be with us to refute those claims and talk with us about the importance of knowing what the Bible says and being prepared for the second coming of Jesus. And, of course, we will take your call. So glad to have you along today on this Washington Watch as we try to get our first guest up here. Just want to talk about a couple of things in the news. First of all, we just want to make sure that we are praying for the people of Puerto Rico. My goodness. You know, if you know folks that are either down there or people who have family, we just really need to continue to pray for their recovery down there and as well as Mexico. So just keep those people in your prayers, and there are lots of opportunities as well to help those folks. Well, let's move on to our first topic. Many believe that a full repeal of Obamacare is necessary, including the Family Research Council. But ending a forced partnership with taxpayers and Planned Parenthood is a good first step. But that first step might not even get a chance, as Senator John McCain just this afternoon, announced his opposition to the Graham-Cassidy proposal. With us now is Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment, a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington. Phil, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, breaking news, as I mentioned, John McCain says in good conscience, as he says it, he can't support the proposal. First of all, Phil, get us up to speed on what Graham-Cassidy is. You know, we've heard so many different variations and combinations and permutations of different health care bills. Give us a kind of a capsulized version of what Graham-Cassidy does or would do if it were passed.
Well, it repeals the mandates, which are really, I think, the beating heart of Obamacare, the individual mandate that requires everyone to buy Obamacare-approved insurance or pay a $695 fine or 2.5% of income, whichever is greater. That's the individual mandate. It repeals that. It repeals the employer mandate, which is the requirement that every employer offer Obamacare-approved coverage or pay a penalty of $2,000 per employee. And that employer mandate is driving a lot of companies to stay under 50 employees because it kicks into 50 employees, or to cut people's hours under 30 hours per week because it applies to everyone above 30 hours per week. So that's had a very negative impact. It repeals the medical device tax, which is a tax on medical innovation, including on companies that are inventing devices, even if they aren't profitable yet, because it was designed as a tax on gross receipts, which is a terrible way to design a tax. And it defunds Planned Parenthood. And those are kind of the major provisions that are in there. The way it handles the Obamacare subsidies is different than the other bills that have been offered to this point by Republicans. Rather than repeal them completely or restructure them as a new federal subsidy program, it replaces them with a block grant to the states, and it gives the states the authority through a waiver to get rid of all the federal regulations if they want to, keep the ones they want to, and so forth. But really, it lets the states design the manner in which they will deliver the funding that currently goes to Obamacare subsidies and the Medicaid expansion. So it sends a lot of money to the state capitals. And that's basically the structure of the bill. The other thing that's of great significance to your listeners and that I know FRC worked very, very hard on is that it subjects all of the money in the bill to HIDE protections. And that is a major improvement over Obamacare because the subsidies in Obamacare, you'll recall, were not subject to HIDE protections. Bart Stupak wanted to add them in the House. His amendment was stripped in the Senate, and ultimately he caved and agreed to pass the bill without it, and just with an executive order from President Obama kind of claiming that tax dollars won't go to abortions. But the way that Obamacare in practice works, the subsidies go into plans, and those plans cover abortions. They have an accounting gimmick to pretend they don't. But in practice, under Obamacare, tax dollars are funding abortions, and under this bill, all of those subsidies are replaced by these new block grants, and the block grants are subject to the HIDE language, so they're prohibited from being used to pay for abortion except in cases of rape, incest, and when the life of the mother is in danger.
And when you say HIDE exceptions, that's Henry Hyde, the congressman who essentially passed legislation way back when that said taxpayer dollars cannot be used to fund abortion. Do I have that correctly?
Yeah, other than those exceptions. Rape,
right, life, right, the exceptions. You know, you talked about Medicaid. What does it mean that every state Medicaid director opposes the Graham-Cassidy bill? What's with that?
Well, I think that's mostly a fake headline. If you look at the actual letter, first of all, it wasn't a letter signed by all 50. It was a letter signed by an umbrella organization that the state Medicaid directors are a part of, and it didn't say that they opposed the bill necessarily. It said that they're concerned about the logistical challenges of the states being ready in time because the block grant under this bill starts in 2020, which is a pretty short ramp-up time when you're talking about basically 2 years to get ready for this. And that would be a challenge for them. It would be logistically difficult, but I don't think it's insurmountable. And in particular, I think the easiest model for states to follow would just be to use pre-funding of health savings accounts and whatever population, however they want to determine eligibility, they could just put money into HSAs for people, and they could use it to either buy insurance policies or to pay for care directly, and that might be one way that would be relatively straightforward logistically to implement the block grants. But I think the headlines, and I saw the same headlines you did, I think they overstated what the letter was actually saying, which was just we're concerned that it would be logistically challenging for us to get these new programs up and running in time.
So you're saying that essentially that the bill would shift some of the subsidies that that Obamacare basically
all of it,
yes,
100% of it,
still
it all still, of it into the block grant.
Yeah, still a whole lot of taxpayer dollars that we weren't spending before, right?
Well, it actually spends less than Obamacare, although it not a whole lot less. And so that's been one of the criticisms. You know, Rand Paul, for instance, says, well, this spends 90% as much as Obamacare does, and I wanted to cut spending a lot more, so I'm going to oppose the bill. I think it's a very strange way to look at it. I would have preferred to cut spending more and to cut taxes more than this bill does, but it taxes a lot less than Obamacare, and it spends a lot less than Obamacare, and it defunds Planned Parenthood, and it ends the federal funding of abortions, and it sends the money to the state capitals to be spent by state legislatures instead of being micromanaged out of Washington. And so, yeah, it keeps about 90% of the spending in Obamacare. It's not a big spending cut. I'd like to see more, but I don't really understand how that becomes a reason to oppose the bill.
So Obamacare, let's say that that the other candidate had won the presidency. What if you could dig into the brains of the people who put Obamacare together, what was the motivation essentially? Why was this horrible legislation enacted, and what was the eventual goal, do you suppose?
Well, I think that the Democrats in this country, by and large, believe that healthcare is a human right that ought to be guaranteed by government, and they think that they can provide healthcare through government programs better than people can obtain it in a marketplace through private insurance. And the way Obamacare was originally designed, they wanted to have a so-called public option in it, that over time everyone be pushed into that government plan as the private market collapsed. They, for practical reasons, weren't able to put that in the bill. But they, I think that ultimately where they want to get is everyone in a government plan. And if you don't believe that, just look, Bernie Sanders introduced a bill that is mandatory Medicare enrollment for every person in America. It makes private insurance illegal in this country. And that bill, I think, has 15 Democratic co-sponsors. So it's got, you know, fully one-third of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate on board with him. So I think it's pretty clear at this point. You know, they've been denying it for years, but I think it's pretty clear at this point that where the Democrats want this to end up is with every man, woman, and child in this country on a government plan with no choice, and with government making the decisions about what is and isn't covered and what is and isn't allowed, and really the power of life and death over the people. And that's something that I know I've been fighting against for many, many years, and I think most conservatives have been. And, you know, that's really ultimately what the stakes are here. And you know, I think that in that context, and especially the fact this Graham-Cassidy bill was introduced the same week as Bernie Sanders' bill, I'm frankly shocked that there aren't 50 Republicans who are willing to vote for it, because the alternative we're staring at is a pathway to, you know, everyone being in a government health care system.
All right. Well, I started this out by talking about McCain's announcement this afternoon. What's going on with him? What is he saying are the reasons that he's going to oppose it? And does he not get it, what the consequences are that you just mentioned, the consequences of not passing this? It's not perfect. Obviously, nothing is. But it's a step toward getting away from this juggernaut. So why is McCain doing this again?
Well, according to his statement, it's because he believes that a health care bill must be done through regular order in a bipartisan process that goes through all the committees and has lots of hearings and so on and so forth. And it's a very strange rationale for a vote on an issue of this magnitude and importance, because it's essentially a process argument, a procedural argument. What he's saying is, if the identical bill that does all of the same things as this bill had been produced as a chairman's bill coming out of a committee, if, say, Orrin Hatch had written it instead of Lindsey Graham, and therefore it had come out of the Senate Finance Committee instead of coming out of sort of a ad hoc committee, if you will, that Cassidy and Graham put together, then it would be acceptable to him. Then he could vote for it because it came out of the Senate Finance Committee. But I don't, you know, it's hard for me to accept a rationale that basically says I'm voting against the bill not because of what it does and what it says, but because of the process that created it. I just think that's a very strange way to look at it and think about it. I suspect, I don't want to impugn the man's motives, but I suspect it had a lot to do with all of the pressure from all the various liberal groups and the ads and the media and Jimmy Kimmel and all of these sort of the vast cultural onslaught that the left has brought over the last week on this issue.
You know, it's almost as if he doesn't quite understand what's going on around him, even the fact that there's probably no other way to get this thing through, right?
Well, certainly not under the current procedural track. They've got this thing protected from filibuster by the fiscal 2017 budget resolution. That expires on September 30th. And so if they're going to make another run at this in the future, it's going to have to be through a different procedural process. And that means a lot of ramp up and a lot of other challenges. It makes it very unlikely it'll happen before the elections next year.
Well, Phil Kirpin is the president of American Commitment, a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington. Phil, thanks for sharing your insight with us this afternoon on Washington Watch.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
Coming up next, last night, some of the most biased reporters in media were awarded at the annual Media Research Center's Gala. We'll talk with Tim Graham, and we'll do that in just a few minutes when we return right here on Washington Watch.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? Our founding fathers knew that God's transcendent truth must be the foundation for all law. Since the early 20th century, however, truth-based rule of law has changed dramatically in America. The progressive era ushered in big change, shifting our standards to make it appear that truth is ever-evolving. America's founding fathers determined truth from a fixed source, God. But progressives determined that truth originated with man, thereby making it possible to change the truth in order to fit shifting cultural opinions and to undergird the power of those elected in office. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston reveals the importance of truth founded in God and the consequences of moral relativism. Is truth fixed or is it subject to change? The future existence of our free democracy hinges on answering this question correctly. Go to frc.org/decay to learn more.
In America, we face a media onslaught against the Christian perspective. It is now seen as anti-cultural and invalid. Dr. Michael Paulson, a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, talked about how Christians can respond intellectually. Dr. Paulson has researched common arguments against religious liberty. For example, religious values are no different than ethical values. Dr. Paulson argues that the law should give religious exemptions because of the perspective of a religious person who necessarily believes in God as an ultimate source. Religion is different and necessitates a different kind of devotion. Moreover, the Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom of exercise. The Christian perspective is one that is not outdated, but still present and still valid according to the Constitution. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. A senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
Trumpocalypse.
Now confirmed that Secretary Clinton has conceded to Donald Trump. This concession took place in a phone call.
It is my high honor to introduce to you the President-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
This is it, the end of the presidential race, and it feels like the end of the world.
When you walk around our world and you see everybody is crying and so upset, and it is the end of their world.
A night that appears to be absolutely disastrous.
Tens of millions of Americans are totally fine with a man who's driven almost purely by racism and sexism and Islamophobia, of hatred of everyone unlike him.
I want to throw up.
Yeah.
It feels like we're trying to avoid the apocalypse and half of the country is voting for the asteroid.
Outside of the Civil War, World War II, and including 9/11, this may be the most cataclysmic event the country's ever seen.
Well, you probably thought you were listening to MSNBC or CNN, but fear not. Fear not, dear friend. This is Washington Watch. This is Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network. We're back here with you. And, well, last night, that audio was from the Media Research Center's one-of-a-kind, star-studded gala event in our nation's capital. MRC's 30th anniversary featured prominent politicians, pundits, and television and radio hosts. With us now is Tim Graham. He's MRC's Director of Media Analysis. Tim, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you. That was the Trumpocalypse, was the audio we had there.
Well, tell us about these awards. What? Just help us understand what they're about and how long have you been doing them?
Well, we've been having this dinner for about 15 years, and basically we create some categories and let the audience vote on which was the worst quote in this category. So we had, you know, the worst Obama Valentine. We had the, you know, this one, basically we decided there was so much anti-Trump bias, we decided not to have a competition. We just strung them all together and said, here, watch all this in one big swoop. But, I mean, it's kind of our time to, Cal Thomas called it the anti-Emmys last night. It was, you know, us just kind of enjoying this when they really freak out about stuff.
Well, you know, the crying and all that sort of thing, I think most people have gotten over their crying spells, and now they're, who knows what's going on. But apparently you've got an award called the Most Outrageously Biased Liberal Reporting Award, and, there's so much of it. I don't know how you could sift through all the potential entries, but who ended up winning it, and for what?
Yeah, I think that was the Brian Williams, was that? Trying to remember, but you know, Brian Williams was one of them, one of the winners. He had suggested shortly after Fidel Castro died in Cuba that that Havana was one of those capitals where you can still see people in donkey carts being driven in donkey carts because that's the way they liked it.
I see.
It's one of those things that you rewind and play again because you're like, did he really say that? Yes, he did really say that.
And I understand also Rush Limbaugh spoke at this event. What did he have to say?
Well, that was terrific. And basically, we were, you know, Rush is in his 30th year on the air, and the MRC was started in August of 1987. And he had some really nice notes about how, remembering just how desperate we were in 1987, that there was really no conservative media to speak of. And it's amazing that Ronald Reagan was able to succeed in politics back then when there was no conservative talk radio, really. There was no Fox News. And I think he was suggesting in the evolution of conservative media that Reagan sort of created the conditions for conservative media, and then we've all been a part of, making conservative media more and more powerful. And I think part of that is, yes, when we have all pounded away at how the liberal media isn't great at the facts, it's a lot better at propaganda, people wanted the other side. They're like, we want the other side. We want news that the liberal media thinks shouldn't be news because it's not helpful to the Clintons or helpful to Obama, so therefore it's not news, and that's how we sort of created where we are today.
Okay, so what Media Research Center does, and you can tell us more, but you look at what's going on out there and you do analysis of it. One of the questions I have is, you know, obviously the journalism schools or so-called journalism schools are cranking out skulls of mush who really don't seem to understand what journalism is. Now, there certainly are some exceptions to that. There are some folks who are really trying to do the right thing, but it seems like not very many of them end up on the major mainstream media. Why is that?
Well, there's several different reasons now people get into journalism. Certainly, a lot of people, especially now in the millennial generation, if I can be mean to millennials, I mean, part of it is you want to be a star. You go into news because you want to be on TV. And that's understandable, but that, you know, there's a lot of TV news now that is not substantive, that is not about politics. We have morning show stuff with news about how to polish your nails. But, I mean, I think that so many people get into news now when they really should be getting into politics. They get into journalism to change the world. Well, that's what you're supposed to get into politics to do. You're supposed to get into journalism to tell a story and hopefully to tell a story with two sides.
And with facts.
And with facts. And look, they get so upset in the era of Trump, and they're like, these guys, we can't even agree on facts. And it's like, look, the reality is, that's true. In politics, sometimes we do disagree on what's factual and what's not factual, especially when we have a media that tends to want to say fact, we are more compassionate than you are.
Well, you know, it's when you do see those occasional stories where they're actually sticking to the facts, it's refreshing when you compare it to most of the rest of the stuff that's out there. So how can our listeners find out more about Media Research Center?
Well, we're at mrc.org, and, of course, our blog is newsbusters.org.
Very good. Newsbusters.org. Tim Graham, the MRC's Director of Media Analysis, thanks for joining us today on Washington Watch. Appreciate it. Well, coming up next, can you imagine being a fifth grader and not using the correct pronoun when addressing your teacher? Talk about confusing. Well, that's what's happening at a Tallahassee, Florida school. Next, we'll be talking with Kathy Roos, Senior Fellow of Legal Studies at the Family Research Council. We'll be right back.
Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news.
Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Evan Fowler at Washington Watch back with you on this Friday afternoon. Glad to have you along. A Florida elementary school teacher's letter asked fifth grade students to use gender-neutral pronouns, and parents are angry. This seems to be a growing trend in elementary schools across the country. Joining us now to talk about it is Kathy Roos, Senior Fellow of Legal Studies with the Family Research Council. Kathy, you've been following this trend. Tell us, first of all, about the Tallahassee situation.
Well, there was a thank you for having me on, by the way. It's so sad to have to follow this trend, but it is a trend that is, it's like a train that is going through our nation right now in our nation's schools. In Florida, a fifth grade teacher sent a letter home to parents introducing herself and announcing to the parents that the students were to call her by the prefix MX. She says is pronounced mix as opposed to Miss or Mrs., and that students are to call her by the pronouns they, them, and their rather than he, his, she, or hers. And let me tell you, that did not sit well with many, many parents in this Florida public school. But the principal is standing by the teacher, saying basically this is a matter of basic common courtesy to call the teacher what she wants to be called. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Well, yeah, tell us what more is there to it than that?
Well, first of all, there's a matter of the free speech rights of students. You know, students in public schools do not leave their free speech rights at the school door every morning when they go to school. There are, of course, there are rules of behavior, and that you can't be disruptive. You can't speak or wear shirts that have profanity or that are disruptive to the class. I mean, there are all kinds of rules. A school is not a public place per se, but you have the right to maintain your beliefs, and you cannot be subject. You cannot be mandated to change your beliefs or to affirm a belief that is not true. So, for instance, what we're talking about really is, you know, what do these third-person pronouns mean? These third-person pronouns, he, she, so forth. What they mean is they are an affirmation of a truth. And if children are mandated, for instance, to call a female teacher, a biologically female teacher, if they are required by the school to call her he and Mr., then the school is trying to mandate them to affirm an untruth. And they simply can't do that under the First Amendment. I promise you there will be lawsuits, and I think that the students who file these lawsuits against being manipulated this way, I think have a very good shot of winning these lawsuits. Of all the transgender ideology policies that are being imposed on children in public schools, this free speech one, I think, perhaps has the strongest legal legs. We are not only talking about, policing speech, but it's really thought police to ask you to affirm with your words an untruth. So it actually goes against, it's not simply a matter of being polite. It's an affirmation, and this is the whole point of the game, the pronoun game. This is the racket. Let me read to you from a bit more of this teacher's letter to parents.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
She says, after she says that the students must use they, them, and their.
And now she's a she. Let's establish that first.
As far as we know, she is a biological she, but she doesn't want to be known as a biological she. She wants to be known as a group of people. She wants to be known as they, and she doesn't want to be called Mr. or Mrs., but Mix. She says, I know it takes some practice for this to feel natural, but students will catch on. And that is really, I'm not sure she realizes what she's saying there. It takes some practice for this to feel natural. Those are weighted words. This is something unnatural that she is requiring students to affirm. And if they affirm it enough times, then it will become easy for them, and then it will seem natural to them.
That's certainly the goal. Now, part of this story says that there's some angry parents. What do you know about that aspect of it?
Well, there are some angry parents because they see that this is an ideology that's being pushed onto their children. They are speaking up about it. This just happened, so this whole case hasn't progressed very far. But I'm not surprised to see that parents aren't taking this lying down. According to the article, they're going to Facebook. They're asking the question, they're trying to raise awareness of what's happening in their school. But like I said, unfortunately, the principal is standing by this teacher's request. But as I say, and as a lawyer, and I've read writings from other lawyers on this issue, I don't think the school has a First Amendment case. I think the parents who want to object to this kind of forced speech, depending on how far they want to take it, they will be successful because you have a First Amendment right not to be forced to speak.
Well, you know, it's just more craziness, and hopefully the parents will be bold and they'll challenge the school board or whatever needs to be done so we can kind of get back to some normalcy here, because it's just really kind of gotten ridiculous, hasn't it? Well, so Kathy Roof, Senior Fellow of Legal Studies with the Family Research Council, thanks so much for taking a few moments with us this afternoon. Well, coming up next, a person claiming to be a Christian numerologist predicted Saturday was going to be doomsday, the end of the world. Well, now he's backtracking. And when we return, we'll talk with Dr. Michael Brown about the importance of knowing the truth that only comes from Scripture and what I will call our Twilight Zone segment right here on Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Are you worried about the moral direction of America? Do you feel powerless to make a difference? Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. Established in 1983 in Washington, D.C., Family Research Council conducts research, develops policy, drafts legislation, and educates policymakers, pastors, and the grassroots. It testifies before Congress and shapes public debate through the media and internet. Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about Family Research Council, please visit us at frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news. Again, that's frc.org.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As Senior Director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Hear Mr. Arnakis discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network here sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, let me give you the phone number. Hopefully we'll have some time here to take your calls because this is going to be an interesting next segment. 866-372-7234. That's 866-372-7234. I'll give it to you again as we get into the topic a bit more. Well, the end is nigh, but it may not be as soon as one doomsday writer claims. A fellow by the name of David Mead, who claimed the world is ending tomorrow when a mysterious planet collides with Earth, is now backtracking on the calamitous claim. With us now is Dr. Michael Brown, founder and president of FIRE School of Ministry in Concord, North Carolina. He's also the director of the Coalition of Conscience and host of the daily nationally syndicated talk radio show The Line of Fire, as well as the host of the Apologetics TV show Answering Your Toughest Questions, which airs on the NRB TV network, and that's National Religious Broadcasters TV network. He's also the author of Saving a Sick America, A Prescription for Moral and Cultural Transformation, and in his spare time, he talks to people like me on Washington Watch. Dr. Brown, welcome.
Hey, great to be with you. You know, I knew from the start that the end of the world was not September 23rd because my new book, Saving a Sick America, comes out on September 26th. So that was an easy one for me.
Yeah, had you known that, you wouldn't have gone to all the trouble to write it.
Yeah, look to be really serious about this, I find it unfortunate that Christians are still getting caught up with this. Because it wasn't just this one gentleman making his prediction. People have been asking for months, have you heard about September 23rd and what's going to happen with the planets and Jesus is coming? So I wrote articles. I got on the air. I said, look, he's not coming September 23rd. We don't know the day or the hour, but we can know when it's not the day or the hour. And it's this mentality of we're out of here any minute that is so self-defeating. Because others in our culture, in our world, who have different agendas and different visions of what's right and wrong, they're in it for the long haul. They're thinking multi-generational. They're thinking about bringing incremental change. And whenever we see something bad happening in the world around us, we think, that's it. We're out of here any moment. That's when I heard 46 years ago. So when I came to faith as a 16-year-old heroin-shooting, LSD-using hippie rock drummer, Jesus is coming any minute. It's all lined up. The prophecies have all come to pass. This is it. I was 16 then. Our oldest granddaughter is 16, and Jesus still hasn't come back. So we live in readiness and expectation, but we've got to think in a multi-generational way.
Oh, absolutely. And the standard is Matthew 24:36, right?
Yes, and no one knows the day or the hour, but Jesus did tell us many things that would lead up to his coming. And it's not just a hurricane here or there, or as devastating as that could be, or a solar eclipse here and there. He's talking about all kinds of world upheaval. He's talking about things that have not yet come to pass. So I am eagerly working with the Lord and with his people to help take the gospel to the ends of the earth and to stand up for what's right in the society around us and to be responsible with my own life. But I'm not living with this mentality that any second it's all over. I mean, why are we doing a radio show instead of just on the street pleading for people to get saved? Why do we have jobs? Why do we go to school? Why do we get married and have families? It's because we know we're here for a while and we have an assignment. Let's give ourselves to the assignment and let the coming of the Lord come on his schedule.
That's right. Well, you know, you talked about the fact that this David Mead prediction is one in a long, long line of predictions like this, whether they're coming from people who are, you know, coming from maybe a semi-Christian point of view or some other kind of apocalyptic thing. Why is it that people buy into this stuff? Have you looked into that?
Yeah, well, of course. Look, there's a positive and there's a negative. The positive is we take the Bible seriously. We believe that Jesus really is returning. We believe that the Bible is speaking in relevant ways to the days in which we live. We believe that things are not just happening by freak natural forces in an unguided way. That's all positive, but our gullibility and naivete is not positive because we have a relationship with God. And it tells us in 1 Thessalonians 5 that the day of his coming will not overtake us like a thief because we are children of the light. That means it's not just going to be, oh, surprise, it's over, oh, there it is, it just happened. So what we need to do is walk in a responsible way as children of the light. Jesus didn't come in 1994 like Harold Camping prophesied. What's worse still is people were still believing him right through May of 2011, October of 2011. Finally, he got discredited. Jehovah's Witnesses were waiting for the second coming in 1914. Millerites were waiting for, 1844. You would think that we would learn a little bit more than to date set. And my understanding of Scripture is, as the coming of the Lord draws near, it is going to be with such intensity with what's happening on the world that those who are asleep in the dark will be caught off guard. But those who are children of the light will know, lift up your heads, your redemption draws near.
Well, so you're the host of the Apologetics TV show, as I said in the introduction, answering your toughest questions. So here's a tough question. It's probably not the toughest you've ever heard, but, you know, people look at, well, you know, we can look at the last, what, month or two with the weather calamities, with the two hurricanes and what happened in Mexico with the earthquake and you know, what just happened to Puerto Rico. And people look at this and they say, you know, if they have a sense that maybe signs of the end times are these kinds of catastrophes. But isn't it true that we've had these kinds of catastrophes throughout history and in some cases worse?
Yeah, I mean, look, what's happened recently is tragic. In Puerto Rico, the devastation there is unreal. And through all of this, I mean, I hear the Lord's voice saying to us, Earth, you need me. My people, you need me. and we need one another. But look at the horrific tsunami that took place, what, over a decade ago? Look at that. Look at all the lives lost. Far worse natural disaster than what happened. And that was 1 year to the day after a massive earthquake in Iran that took tens of thousands of lives. Go back in history to events like the Black Plague and things that wiped out a third of European society. Look at the horrors of World War II. Look at America during the Civil War, when the casualties there were greater than basically all of our subsequent war casualties. All that to say, the earth has been in upheaval, either people killing people or natural disasters for centuries and centuries, and in some cases worse than we've seen. So I'm not minimizing what's happening. I'm simply saying if there is to be an increase, if Jesus did indeed say that these things will increase before the end, that we have not yet seen that prophesied increase. What we've seen is standard patterns that have been repeating, maybe with a little bit more intensity, but this has been going on for years.
Well, Dr. Brown, since you are the host of Answering Your Toughest Questions, I'm going to open up the phone lines and ask our listeners to call in. If they have a tough question that's related to this particular topic or something that's in close proximity to it, the end times, I want to invite them to call. The number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. That's how you get on board. Dr. Brown, I assume you'd be willing to take those calls. I didn't ask you that first, but...
Oh, with joy. I'm
all right
for questions and calls. And by the way, in my new book, Saving a Sick America, it's interesting we're talking about this because I have a whole chapter on the importance of developing a multi-generational mentality. So I really encourage folks, when they get the book, read it in that context of a multi-generational mentality versus we're out of here any moment mentality.
Yeah, so explain that multi-generational a little bit more clearly. We've got some, boy, the phones are lighting up here, and we'll be taking calls in just a minute. So, but go ahead and give us a brief overview of what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking as a grandfather, what kind of world are my grandkids growing up in? Dietrich Bonhoeffer said the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children. If I think we're out of here any moment, I'm not thinking about that. I'm not thinking about the world my kids or grandkids are going to grow up in. I'm just thinking we got to bring about change now, get as many people saved as we can now because we're out of here. A multi-generational mentality says let's do the best we can in the time we have. Let's reach the maximum people, make the maximum impact. But we may not be the last generation. If there's a generation after us and maybe after that and maybe after that, how can we see them stronger in the faith than we are today? How can we see the world in which they live to be a better world in which they can raise their kids than the way we're raising ours? And I think that we have many times abdicated our responsibility because of a faulty theology.
Oh, absolutely. We have to have that long-term view, don't we? So we have Charlotte on the line from Texas. She's got a question about end-time prophets for Dr. Michael Brown.
Dr. Brown, thank you for taking my question. I just want to have some help understanding why people believe that the end of the world is going to come just suddenly when Scripture is so clear about the thousand-year reign of Christ on earth and us reigning with him. They never seem to take that into account. Can you address that?
Yeah, certainly. Of course, people debate whether there'll be a literal millennium. I believe there will be a thousand-year reign, and Jesus comes before that, so the second coming is pre-millennial. But the second coming itself is before those thousand years. And if, for example, you believe in what's called a pre-trib rapture that was popularized years ago with the Schofield Study Bible and Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth and then the Left Behind series in more recent years, then you believe that Jesus could come without tangible signs and suddenly we're out of here. The New Testament does speak of the end days and the last times, and because of that, it's very easy to have this mentality of the end is near. But I agree with you that there are things that must take place first, but the thousand-year reign is once Jesus returns and establishes his kingdom, comes before that, not after that.
Jim's on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Jim, what's your question for Dr. Brown?
Well, it's not really a question. I wanted to state that my wife, unfortunately, whenever she hears about these different people prophesying the ends and stuff like that, she, like, literally panics, and I always have to calm her down by pointing out, look, I could tell you that it's not the end because too many people saying it is. Now, about the topic about the thousand-year reign, and you were just talking about how a lot of people go into the philosophy of the pre-trib rapture or the post-trib rapture. What is your take on that, out of curiosity?
Yeah, I don't divide over it. I honor those in the body who have different views. This is not an essential of the faith in terms of if we're pre-trib, post-trib, or believe in a literal seven-year tribulation. But I was saved in a pre-trib church, believed that for 4 or 5 years, but then concluded that based on Scripture, that was not what Scripture taught. Whatever tribulation there is, God will keep us through it, but he won't take us out of it. Jesus said in John 17, the prayer was not that God would take us out of the world. Jesus said in John 16, in this world, you'll have tribulation. In fact, Professor Craig Keener and I, noted New Testament scholar, he and I are co-authoring a book, won't be out for probably a year and a half or so, but why we don't believe in a pre-trib rapture, but why we're not afraid of the Antichrist. But again, people I work with around the world have different views on that, and we don't divide over it.
Thanks, Jim. Don is on the line from Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome to Washington Watch, Don.
Okay. I remember several years ago when there was a big flap involving Harold Camping and the Family Radio Ministry. And not only did I not believe Harold Camping, I ultimately quit my involvement with his ministry largely because of what Harold Camping was doing.
Do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, first thing, I don't want to throw stones on somebody now, but there was a lot in Harold Camping's teaching that was way, way out, and he should have been discredited. He should have been rejected as a false teacher many, many years ago. Family Radio, that ministry, was even putting out tracts and encouraging people, get out of the churches, all the churches are corrupt. I mean, just real dangerous, bad stuff. But no one should have been listening to him for years and years because he discredited himself with unbiblical teaching and with false end times prophecy. And even May of 2011, when he said Jesus was returning and he didn't, I made a mistake. It's actually October. Then finally in October, this old man is saying, I was wrong. I'm so sorry I was wrong. I thought it's pathetic because some people are actually going to lose their faith in God over this entirely because they'll think the whole thing is wrong. So again, I hate to mention names like this, but this was a significant false teacher that led many astray. We should have stopped listening to him a long time ago.
Dr. Brown, thanks for taking the calls. We've got another one here from Jim in Texas. Jim, welcome to Washington Watch. What's your question for Dr. Michael Brown?
I was curious. I've been hearing a lot about a Dr. Rabbi Samuel, I guess, who had a prediction quite a few years ago about 10 jubilees, and the prediction concludes in 2018. Is that correct, and what is that all about?
First, I've not heard of it. Second, I'd completely ignore it, even if I did hear about it. That's another date I'd put on my calendar to ignore. This is just speculation. This is just trying to find something in the Bible that's not there. Look, after the interview, I have to head somewhere using GPS. I'm going to follow what the GPS says. Turn here, 2 miles here, right here, left here. I'm not looking for some secret esoteric meshes in the names of the streets that I'm passing. That's the same kind of stuff. Let's go by what's plainly laid out in the Bible, and let's not get caught up in these secondary imaginary things.
Well, one more quick call. William from Texas is on the line. William, thanks for joining us on Washington Watch. Quick question and quick answer.
Yes, sir. I would want to know your opinion on where some people think, not they don't know what year, but they think Jesus would come back on the Feast of Trumpets.
You can make an argument that Jesus is coming back, the blast of the trumpet, the ram's horn, Matthew 24, 1 Thessalonians 4, 1 Corinthians 15, Revelation 11. You can make a case for that being the time he comes back, or you could also make a case that it symbolizes that, points to that. I wouldn't be dogmatic either way.
Thank you, Dr. Michael Brown, founder and president of Fire School of Ministry. We appreciate your time and all your great answers. Well, this is wrapping up another week of Washington Watch. Eben Fowler again sitting in for Tony Perkins. You can go to frc.org/radio and listen to this program or previous programs again. It's been great sitting in for Tony today, and thank you for listening.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C.
For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.